Hello and welcome to part two of the Return to Pleasure Island podcast. This is part two of a four-part podcast. Try and say that three times fast with ice cubes in your mouth. Four-part podcast of me reading the short story Return to Pleasure Island, as originally published in Realms of Fantasy and subsequently reprinted in my short story collection, A Place So Foreign and Eight More, which was published in 2003 by Four Walls, Eight Windows Press. And you can order that on the internet or buy it in finer bookstores everywhere. Not much news this week, just a couple of little announcements. One is that there's a new podcast science fiction anthology series called Voices that you can get at Podio Books, spelled just like it sounds, podiobooks.com/voices, podiobooks/voices. This is a new science fiction anthology of stories that have been podcast, and it collects my story and his game, which listeners to this podcast will remember as having been read by Alice Taylor of the Wonderland blog, still one of the most popular of the podcasts I've done to date. The Emerging Tech Conference is coming up next week in California, starting on Monday in San Diego at the Hyatt. I'm going to be there for the whole week, so I'm just getting ready for another transoceanic trip from London to California. Looking forward to seeing some sunlight and getting some warmth in. It's been kind of cold and damp here. And the other news, for those of you who are stuck in the cold and damp in London, is that on the 19th of March, I'm having an open house here at my office, which is actually going away. We've lost our lease. So I do these semi-public events once a month called Copyfighters Drunken Brunches and Talking Shops, where we have a kind of champagne brunch or cheap champagne process wine brunch, get a little tipsy, and go across the road to Speaker's Corner and give impromptu speeches about copyright. If this is your idea of a good time, I urge you to come by on the 19th of March at 11 o'clock, Stanhope Center, at the bottom of Stanhope Place. You can find all the information on craphound.com, and I hope to see you there. On with the show, part two of what story am I reading? I can't believe I've forgotten. Part two of Return to Pleasure Island. Thanks. Boys ran up and down the midway, baking in the midday sun. They reminded George of the boys he'd gone to school with after the social worker had come to his father's shack. They teased him to begin with, but he just stood with his hands at his sides until they stopped. Every time he started a new grade or a new kid came to the school, it was the same. They'd tease him or hit him or throw things at him, and he'd stand strong and silent until they stopped, even if it took months. The teachers quickly learned that calling on him in class meant standing in awkward silence while he sat stoic and waited for them to call on someone else. The social worker could make him go to school with the soft ones, but she couldn't make him act like one. George watched the boys carefully as he had when he'd stood silently in the schoolyard, not seeming to watch anything. He was better at spotting a donkey than any of the soft ones. When a boy was ready to turn, George could almost see the shape of the donkey superimposed on him, and he radioed a keeper to pick up the donkey come morning. He got a bonus for each one he spotted, and according to Bill, it had accumulated to a sizable nest egg. George looked at the inventory and decided that the fudge was getting a little long in the tooth. He'd start pushing fudge nut dips, and by the end of his shift, the tub would be empty, and he'd be able to give it a thorough cleaning and refill it from fresh stock. "Hey, guys," he called to three boys, "is anybody hungry?" He dipped a floss and held it up so that it oozed fudge down his wrist. The boys shyly approached his booth. George knew from their manner that they were new to the island, probably just picked up from a video arcade or laser tag tent in the mainland that afternoon. They didn't know what to make of their surroundings, that was clear. "Step right up," he said, "I don't bite." He smiled a smile he'd practiced in the mirror, one that shaped his soft, flexible features into a good-natured expression of idiotic fun. Cautiously, the boys came forward. They were the target age, 11 to 14, and they'd already accumulated some merch, baseball hats and fanny packs made from neoprene and tropical fish colors, emblazoned with the island's logo marks and character trademarks. They had the beginnings of dark circles under their eyes, and they dragged a little, with low blood sugar. George dipped two more and distributed them around. The eldest, a tow-headed kid near the upper age range, said, "Mister, we haven't got any money. What do these cost?" George laughed like a freight train. "It's all free, sonny, free as air, courtesy of the management, as a reward for very special customers like you." This was scripted, but the trick was to sell the line like it was fresh. The boys took the cones from him timidly, but ate ravenously. George gave them some logoed serviettes to wipe up with, and ground the fudge into his wrists and forearms with one of his own. He took his watch and consulted the laminated timetable taped to the counter. 1,300 hours, which meant that the bulk of the guests would be migrating toward Action Land and the dinosaur rides, and it was time to push the slightly down-at-heels Freak Zone to balance the crowds. "You boys like roller coasters?" he said. The youngest, they were similar enough in age and appearance and distant, similar enough in appearance and distant enough in age to be brothers, spoke up. "Yeah!" The middle kid elbowed him, and the youngest flipped the middle, the bird. "Well, if you follow the midway around this curve to the right and go through the big clown mouth, you'll be in the Freak Zone. We've got a 15-story coaster called the Obliterator that loops 50 times in 5 minutes, running over 95 miles per hour. If you hurry, you can beat the line." He looked the youngest in the eye at the start of the speech, then switched to the middle when he talked about the line. The youngest started vibrating with excitement, and the middle looked pensive, and then the eldest said, "Sounds good, huh, Tom?" The middle one said, "We haven't found out where we're sleeping yet. Maybe we can do the ride afterwards." George winked at the youngest, then said, "Don't worry about it, kids. I'll get that sorted out for you right now." He picked up the White House phone and asked the operator to connect him with guest services. "Hi there, this is George on the Midway. I need reservations for 3 young men tonight. A suite, I think, with in-room Nintendo and a big-screen TV. They look like they'd enjoy the Sportsaterium. Okay, I'll hold." He covered the mouthpiece and said to the boys, "You'll love the Sportsaterium. The chairs are shaped like giant catcher's mitts, and the beds are giant Air Jordans, and the suite comes with a regulation half-court. What name should I put the reservation under?" The eldest said, "Tom Mitchell." George made the reservation. "You're all set," he said. "The monorails run right into the hotel lobby every 10 minutes. Anyone with a name tag can show you to the nearest stop. Here's a tip. Try the Football Panzerotto. It's a fried pizza turnover as big as a football with beef jerky laces. It's my favorite." "I want a football," the youngest said. "We'll have it for dinner," the eldest said, looking off at the skyline of coaster skeletons in the distance. "Let's go on some rides first." George beamed his idiot grin at them as they left. Then his face went slack, and he went back to wiping down the surfaces. A moment later, a hand reached across the counter and plucked the cloth from his grip. He looked up, startled, into Joe's grinning face. Unlike his brother's, Joe's face was all sharp angles and small teeth. No one knew what a child of the tongue was supposed to look like, but George had always suspected that Joe wasn't right, even for a third son. "Big guy," Joe shouted, "working hard?" George said, "Yes." He stood patiently, waiting for Joe to give him the cloth back. Joe held it over his head like a standard, dancing back out of reach, even though George hadn't made a grab for it. George waited. Joe walked back to his counter and gave it back. "We're dozing the Freak Zone," Joe said, in a conspiratorial whisper. He put a spin on "we're," making sure that George knew he was including himself in with the island's management. "Really?" George said, neutrally. "Yeah, we're going to flatten that sucker, start fresh, and build us a new theme land. I'm a strategic project consultant. By the time it's over, I'll be an Imagineer." George knew that the lands on Pleasure Island were flattened and rebuilt on a regular basis, as management worked to stay ahead of the light-speed boredom threshold of the mainland. Still, he said, "Well, Joe, that's marvelous. I'm sure you'll do a fabulous job." Joe sneered at him. "Oh, I know I will. We all do just fabulous jobs, brother. Just some of us have fabulous jobs to do." George refused to rise to the bait. You could always outweigh Joe. Joe said, "We're thinking of giving it a monster theme. Monsters are testing very high with 11 to 14s this year. Dragons, ogres, cyborgs, you know. We might even do a walkthrough. There hasn't been one of those here since the 60s. George didn't know what Joe wanted him to say. He said, "That sounds very nice." Joe gave him a pitying look, and then his chest started ringing. He extracted a slim phone from his shirt pocket and turned away. A moment later, he turned back. "Gotta go," he said. "Meeting with Woodrow and Orville, down at Ops." Alarm bells went off in George's head. Shouldn't Bill go along with you if you're meeting with Orville? Joe sneered at him, then took off at a fast clip down the midway. George watched him until he disappeared through one of the access doors. Bill was clearly upset about it. George couldn't help but feel responsible. He should have called Bill as soon as Joe told him he was meeting with Orville, but he'd waited until he got home. He'd been home for hours, but still George wasn't back. Bill plucked absently at the dinner he'd made and fretted. "He didn't say how Orville found out?" Bill asked. George shook his head mutely. "Why didn't he invite me?" Bill asked. "I always handle negotiations for us." George couldn't eat. The more Bill fretted, the more he couldn't eat. It was long dark outside, hours and hours after Joe should have been home. Bill fretted, George stared out the window, and Joe didn't come home. Then an electric cart's headlights swept up the trail to their cabin. The lights dazzled George, so he couldn't see who was driving. Bill joined him at the window and squinted. "It's Joe and Orville," he said. George squinted too, but he couldn't make out anything. He took Bill's word for it and joined him outside. It was indeed Orville and Joe. Orville was driving, and Joe was lolling drunkenly beside him. Orville shook hands with Bill and nodded to George, who lifted Joe out of the cart and carried him inside. When he got back, Orville and Bill were staring calmly into each other's eyes, each waiting for the other to say something. Orville was dressed in his working clothes, a natty white suit with a sports shirt underneath. His bald head gleamed in the moonlight. His fleshy, unreadable face was ruddy in the glow from the cabin's door. George bit his tongue to keep from speaking. "He's drunk," Orville said, at last. Orville didn't beat around the bush. "I can see that," Bill said. "Did you get him drunk?" "Yes, I did. We were celebrating." Bill's eyes narrowed. "So you know." Orville smiled. "Of course I know. I set it up. I thought you'd approve. Joe clearly needed something to keep him out of trouble." Bill said, "This will keep him out of trouble?" Orville leaned against the cart's bumper, pulled out a pipe, stuffed it, and lit it. He puffed at it and watched the smoke wisp away in the swamp breezes. "I think that Joe's really going to like life with the Imagineers. They're management's precious darlings who can do no wrong. Anything they ask for, they get. There won't be any more discipline problems." Bill said, "Why not?" Orville grinned without showing his teeth. "Where there's no discipline, there's no discipline problems. He can work whatever hours he wants. He'll have access to anything he needs. Budget, staff, an office, whatever. It's his dream job." Bill said, "I don't like this." George wondered why not. It sounded pretty good to him. Orville puffed at his pipe. "Like it or not, I think you'll have a hard time convincing Joe not to do it. He's sold." Bill went back into the cabin and closed the door. "He took that well, don't you think?" Orville asked. George said, "I suppose so." Orville said, "Is everything working out all right for you? Shifts okay? Co-workers?" George said, "Everything's fine, thank you." Orville tapped his pipe out on the bumper, then got back into the cart. "All right, then. Good night, George."